You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk can be supported by listeners like you at patreon.com/monstertalk or by leaving positive reviews on iTunes and other podcasting sites. Learn more at monstertalk.org/support. Thanks to all of you who are supporting us in this way. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or exceed your expectations.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Some of our listeners may look at the title of this episode and wonder, why is Monster Talk doing an episode on the platypus? At first glance, this may seem like I'm trying to shoehorn in a nature documentary with no connection to monsters, but let me make my case. Let's just look at the cryptid angle. Longtime listeners will know that I frequently protest the use of the coelacanth, the gigantic deepwater fish that has strongly maintained its outward shape compared to its fossil ancestors from several hundred million years ago, as an avatar of cryptozoology. The cryptozoological literature likes the idea of this living fossil, which I get. It sounds cool, but it also demonstrates a gross misunderstanding of evolution and natural selection. The coelacanth of today may be recognizable as similar to its fossil ancestors, but 400 million years of genetic changes have indeed happened. To an untrained eye, you might think that they're the same, but they are not. This is very similar to the crocodilians. Again, if you get past the human tendency to just group a bunch of features together, those animals have also changed dramatically, even though they're recognizably related to each other. I mean, the crocodilians are related to their fossil ancestors, not that they're related to the coelacanths, although with DNA, I guess that's true too. Anyway, my point is, this whole living fossil idea, while dramatic, misses the whole point of what constitutes a cryptid. According to research by a friend of the show, Dr. Brian Regal, the word cryptid was coined in 1983 by cryptozoologist J.E. Wall, who was trying to make the field more scientifically respectable by pulling away from this idea of monsters. The key feature of a cryptid, then, becomes something about how the monster is legendary, and then the cryptozoology seeks to find the real and natural creatures behind these legends. But nobody was telling stories about the mysterious encounters with the coelacanth. It was just this weird-looking fish that people sometimes caught. The platypus, though? That's another story. We briefly touched on this in our interview, but let me tell you, with a little more detail plugged in, the story of George Kersley Shaw. In 1799, he published one of the first scientific papers on the platypus, but all he had been able to work with was reports from people who had observed the animals and a dried pelt. Like many others who considered the reports, the animal sounded ludicrous. It's a mammal, but it has a bill like a duck. It lays eggs. The Europeans who met them were calling them water moles, but here was a creature that looked like a mashup of multiple kinds of creatures. Now, we have a name for creatures like that, derived from Greek mythology. We call them chimeras. And taxidermied hoaxes were common. So Shaw looked for signs of stitching or other hoax indicators in his specimen, and even though he wrote it up as a real creature, he admitted that it did have the air of trickery about it, yet it was a real animal. So here we have it, a real animal, told about in legend, with incredibly peculiar features. I would posit to you, dear listener, that the humble platypus is a far better candidate as an icon for cryptozoology than the coelacanth. But let's hear more about this animal, because when I say it has incredible features, there's a good chance you may not have even heard of how odd this little animal is. In part one, we're going to be discussing the habitat and the challenges in studying these animals. And in part two, we'll dive deep into their biology. Exciting mammals, the platypus.
Monster Dog.
Tonight, we're talking to Dr. Gilad Bino. And we're going to be talking about one of the most fascinating and, at least in my experience, little understood animals out there. But yet, mm-hmm. It has so many unique properties and so many interesting characteristics that I think it's going to be a real win for us to get more information on this. So would you like to introduce yourself, Dr. Bino?
Yeah. Hello. My name is Gilad. I'm a researcher at the Center for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales in Australia. I live in Mullumbimby, which is a lovely little town in Australia. And I've been very passionate about conservation. And I've been really enjoying the scientific process of raising questions and trying to answer them. So I kind of this combination of my passion for conservation and scientific procedures, I guess, and frame of mind have been keeping me in academia for, I finished my, I went through an undergrad and master's and PhD, which I completed in 2011. And I've been a full-time researcher since then. So it's been about 11 years. I've been studying terrestrial and freshwater systems. And I spend most of my time now, studying freshwater ecosystems, and trying to, find ways where we can kind of strike a balance between the natural environment and human, desire for well-being. And so I apply science for conservation and to inform management. And I do that also through education and what we call outreach. Through the media and the engagements with school and other stakeholders and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are perfect for this show, and we're so glad to have you here to talk about the platypus today. And I think the first question that we all have is, what's the plural for platypus? Is it platypuses or platypi? We've been arguing about this.
Yeah, definitely the number one question I get every time. It's my first slide in any presentation I give is what's the plural term? So the term platypus is is a Greek word that comes from the meaning of a flat foot. And so because it's a Greek word rather than a Latin one, the plural of platypus would be platypuses or platypodes or even platypoda. But I think there's quite a consensus nowadays on platypuses. And so
there we go.
Yeah, after you say a lot of you get used to it after a while. Platypuses. And so, it's fine. It rolls off the tongue. So
that's good. Solved now. But what about the term duck-billed? Because I grew up in Australia and that was the term that we used. Is that the correct term or where did that come from?
Yeah, one of the key features of the platypus is its kind of duck-like bill that it has. And so I think that the name is not, it's referred to as duck bill platypus. And I think whether like it's the official name, I'm not too sure about that, but it's,
sorry, I was just thinking about a term like koala bear, which is, you know, they're not actually bears. And I wondered if duck-billed platypus was inaccurate somehow, or if that's acceptable to use that term.
You can use it. It's a, yeah, it's not like inappropriate to call a platypus a duck-billed platypus.
That's good. It's like the American cow. It's okay to casually call it a cow. You don't have to use its scientific name, the moo cow, every time.
Oh, yeah.
I think officially it's like just platypus, but it's referred to as duck-billed platypus sometimes.
Well, we wanted you to talk about this because it's one of the most peculiar animals in some ways. And famously, I've heard that when the first specimens were sent back to Europe, that the scientists thought it was a hoax. And I thought maybe that's a good theme if true, and you probably can address that, because it reminds me so much of the chimera and the idea of chimeras, of an animal that's slapped together from parts of other animals. That's not what's going on here, but I think maybe over the course of this conversation, we can talk a little bit about convergent evolution, how some of these features came to be. But is that true? That did scientists believe they were being joked upon when the first specimens were sent back?
Yeah, apparently that's the story. When the first specimens made it, they thought it was a hoax. It was a dead specimen, and so they really thought it was like stitched together. We'll talk about all these like weird features that the platypus has, but it makes me wonder. I mean, like, so is that the only case where maybe it was there like a lot of hoaxes being pulled at the time? Like, was it because?
Well, there is.
It makes you wonder.
The Piltdown hoax.
Yeah, and there have been a lot of hoaxes. Yeah, the Fiji mermaid. There's lots of gaffes and Jenny Hanover's. I might be messing that up. There's a lot of certainly sea creatures that were sewn together or put together, or you know. I think there is a lot of hoaxery, a lot of shenanigans.
Must have been, yeah. So, so the platypus was perceived as a hoax. But I think the platypus expert, but in terms of it, like the history, I'm trying to scratch my memory. There were some attempts to, I think, bring over live specimens. It really exemplifies how difficult it is to like captive rear platypuses in terms of like their requirements for. Feeding it is quite, I think it's one of the more expensive animals to actually keep in captivity.
Well, I'm lucky in that I have seen them before. I've gone to museums as a kid, and so I know that they're nocturnal, so it's not like you're just going to come across one in the wild, really. But I'm wondering if you can tell us about its behavior, because they're such fascinating creatures. They're so different. Some of the behavior questions, like do they lay eggs and how long do they live and what do they eat? Anything you can tell us about them?
I can go into like an hours long monologue.
Yeah, yeah. Read their character sheet to us.
All right, let's dive. Literally. Platypuses spend most of their time in the water. They're endemic to Australia, specifically Eastern Australia. They're found all the way from like far north Queensland around Cooktown all the way down to Tasmania. So for our international listeners, if you look at the map, like that's a continental, you know, obviously Australia is a massive landmass. Extent of the platypus spans across a very large latitudinal gradient, which means that it inhabits a wide range of climates, all the way from from tropical up in far north Queensland to alpine in southeast New South Wales and Victoria, like the alpine range, and all the way down to Tasmania, which is it's quite cold there, and so it inhabits historically. I mean, there are fossils of monotremes. That's the family of of the platypus. So the platypus is related. It shares like the taxonomic family with the echidna. And so platypuses, the monotremes, you find fossils of platypuses in like South America and Antarctica and things like that. So it's, you know, genetically and evolutionary, it has we'll go into that maybe later, but it occurred across a wide range of environments in its prehistoric history.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Everybody, shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
So currently the platypus in Australia is confined to, it inhabits rivers and freshwater systems. It is dependent on, in terms of its food, it eats what we call like macro invertebrates, or like the big spineless bugs, as I call them, which are, a lot of it is like the nymph and larval stages of dragonflies and mayflies and damselflies. It also eats freshwater crustaceans. We call them yabbies here. So the glass shrimps, they're quite small. We're not sure like how much of their diet is, they may eat maybe small fish. I don't know if it's like incidental or not, or they could eat some of these like freshwater worms and things like that. So that's their diet, which is, really, the, you know, there are some of these species, these like water bug species are, could be quite sensitive to the water quality. And so, like, really, where you find platypuses, seem to be quite resilient to like varying conditions. We can even find them in some degraded systems, but it's really dependent on two things, food availability and the condition of the riverbanks. So, platypuses, they spend most of the time in the water foraging for food. But when they're not foraging, they dig burrows in the sides of banks. So they really dependent on like stable earthen banks. And so they dig these burrows, and that are dependent on like the stability of these burrows are really dependent on the condition of the like overhanging trees, what we call like the riparian vegetation. So that's really important for the condition of the riparian vegetation along rivers is really dependent, like very important for platypuses, and also for like maintaining the food web in the water.
These burrows, are they for a single animal or for a family group, or how big are these?
So platypuses are solitary. And I'll go in a second into the, like, their mating behavior, but they're pretty much solitary. We don't really have a good understanding in terms of like their interactions with each other. Sometimes, maybe we can talk about it. Like when we trap platypuses, sometimes we trap, like we put a net in the water, and sometimes I'll get two platypuses at the same spot in the net. And it makes me like wonder, like two females. And I wonder what sort of interactions they might have, but mostly they're solitary. Now platypuses, they have what we call like resting burrows, which are relatively short burrows that they use to spend the daytime. So platypuses spend most of their time foraging at night. In winter months, they don't go into like a hibernation or a torpor or anything like that. They platypuses stay active throughout the year, even in alpine climates. A colleague of mine has this story of seeing platypuses forage underneath like a sheet of ice in the alpine region. I've been catching platypuses in sub-zero temperatures, like we're talking Celsius, where our nets kind of freeze overnight, and we have to thaw them by splashing a bit of freezing cold water on it just to untie the knots. But platypuses, yeah, they keep going. So they have these resting burrows. Mm-hmm. And during the breeding season, platypuses, the female platypuses dig a nesting burrow, which are much more complex in structure, and they can extend up to like a they think they span almost like in total length can be 20 to 30 meters. A very complex.
Whoa, wow.
Yeah, it's a very complex structure with like dead ends and potentially like fake entrances. I'm not too sure if it's like intentionally, but they go through a fair bit of effort to construct these like nesting burrows. As the name refers to it, they build nests. So platypuses construct a nest. They start breeding during September here, October, which is kind of spring. And they build these nests with they carry it's a funny thing. I'll send you a photo. But platypuses, they're able to fold their tail, and they can carry nesting material, and they build this really beautiful nest inside a chamber there. And in which they lay one or two eggs. To answer your question, though, platypuses, I don't think they share a burrow, definitely not a nesting burrow, but that they don't share burrows at the same time. So like they don't, in terms of like they're solitary. So, but a platypus can use multiple burrows. And so what we see is that the same burrow can be used by multiple individuals, but not at the same time. So they don't huddle in together at the end of a long night and things like that. So, yeah.
Well, I've got a question for you. Since they're solitary and they're nocturnal and they just seem so elusive, are they endangered?
That's been a really big problem, and was really what got me into this whole thing is we were chatting to a colleague, a researcher called Tom Grant. He's almost like semi-retired now, but he spent all his life studying platypuses. And one thing through discussions that we've had with him originally was that because of the difficulty, like the platypuses, they're so cryptic. They spend all their time in the water and mostly at night. The best times to see a platypus, if you're like in Australia and you want to go see a platypus, is either dusk or dawn. And you have to go and wait by the river and, maybe you'll get in some places where you can get a glimpse of a platypus or two. And if the timing and the season is right, somebody just sent me a video of two platypuses breeding. So yeah, you can definitely get glimpses of them.
Cool.
But it's really hard to understand, estimate numbers from these kind of glimpses. And so the platypus has really been suffering from out of sight, out of mind kind of mentality, where everyone's like, oh yeah, they're platypuses in the river, but they're so hard to see, but surely they're fine. And so I started studying these platypuses maybe 7-8 years ago. And one of the first things that we did was we looked at old historical newspapers that have been digitized in Australia, and we searched for any term or reference for a platypus. It's only anecdotal, obviously. It's not like a robust way to accurately estimate, but it does give you a bit of insights. And what we've seen is we came across accounts of people describing platypuses in numbers far greater than what we commonly see today. So people referring to like seeing a migration of platypuses moving downstream, or referring to them as a mob, which is like a group, a collective of individuals, or seeing dozens of platypuses in one sitting. So these numbers, like I spend, my time trying to catch as many platypuses as I can when I go to places. And like the most I've caught in a night was, six. So to imagine a place where I'd go to and see dozens of platypuses is beyond, my experience. Our conclusion from that is that there's definitely been a decline in the number of platypuses across their range. We know certain areas where platypuses have gone extinct, have been local extinctions. And so there's this term, it's called shifting baselines. It's when we don't have good data for anything really. And we're not keeping track of what happens over time, our perception and collective memory changes. And you see that with like fisheries and recreational fishing in terms of like the size of fish that people used to catch and the numbers.
That's like the bias of the present. What we know, we think's always been so, and that's not necessarily so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly that. So we know that's been happening. There, our impact on the natural world environment around us has been huge. And so we think that the platypus is no different to other, species around the world, and especially Australia. I mean, Australia has a very poor track record in terms of like the extinction rate of species. It has like the worst mammal extinction rate in the world. And so it has the highest land clearing rate currently in developed countries, and one of the highest in the world. And so there's been the Australian landscape has been tremendously modified since European colonization of Australia about 200 years ago. So the problem with the platypus is really we don't have good, there's no like monitoring framework for platypuses. No one's been really keeping track of platypuses, with the exception of passionate researchers. And so we know like they've gone extinct from South Australia, so where they're listed as endangered from the mainland there. There's an introduced population in Kangaroo Island. Last year they were listed as a threatened species, as vulnerable in the state of Victoria. We made a formal submission for assessment under like the federal law. It's called the EPBC Act here in Australia, to potentially list the platypus as a threatened species. But our assessment was declined, given like you have to hit certain thresholds to meet that. There's very clear criteria of what constitutes as a threatened species. There's these IUCN red listing criteria, which is kind of the global standard for what is considered a species, the extinction risk of a species. Mm-hmm. And so we really didn't, given the available data, And like it was very difficult to provide a robust estimate about like the extent of decline for a species that is so difficult to monitor and has such a wide range, which is kind of, it makes it even harder.
Yeah, that's an incredibly difficult challenge if you don't have a good baseline to try to figure out what are, you can't draw a graph if all you have is, you know, random points and like you don't know mm-hmm. what they mean. Has anybody looked at using environmental DNA to get some baseline material?
So for our assessment, like we were heavily reliant on any observation of a platypus made by members of the public or any like kind of bycatch through scientific research or, you know, surveys of for fish and things like that. So we were using that as a baseline to kind of infer about potential declines, looking at like when was the last year a platypus was recorded or observed in a certain area as an indicator of potential decline in numbers and distribution. We're coming close to that. Like the criteria for listing is for as like the entry level is if you show a decline greater than 30% in distribution or numbers. So we were coming close, but we did launch a citizen science software program with the Australian Conservation Foundation. And so it's like the Platy Project, and it does encourage people to look at it. It feeds continuously from the Atlas of Living Australia, which is kind of the national database for wildlife observations. And so it taps into that and provides a real-time summary of where platypuses have been last seen and summarizes it by the recency of observations and really helps prioritize and direct effort for people to go and, you know, maybe be the first person to ever spot, record a platypus in that area or record a platypus in an area where they haven't been seen in over 20 years. So that kind of information is really important for us to, you know, slowly progress towards coming up with like a robust understanding of where platypuses occur. And to answer your question, more recently, in terms of like the environmental DNA is basically an approach where we can collect samples from the environment and look for traces of genetic material. And so it's we can do that in freshwater systems. So we basically collect some water, we pass it through a filter that's able to really just like trap the fine sediment and genetic material. And then we can take that to the lab and really amplify what we're seeing there. And so this has been a magnificent tool to try and understand occurrences of species. So environmental DNA really gives you get a certain signal of how much genetic material you have in your sample. But it does in essence, it just gives you whether like a presence absence. And so it doesn't have the finesse or the accuracy of like trying to understand how many animals you have there. We also don't know in freshwater, in rivers where, you know, the water is kind of flowing. Obviously we don't have an accurate understanding of like, if you take a sample in a site where that genetic material originated from and how long it takes to degrade in the water.
Right. Right. Are you getting the same catfish 15 miles apart? You know, it's like,
Exactly. So it gives you kind of a sense of like within like, let's say the 2 kilometers or 3 kilometers upstream at the most. But we're using eDNA nowadays specifically for platypuses and other freshwater species. So there's a massive effort now by colleagues of mine in New South Wales and Victoria. And I just came back from Queensland where we did some surveys there. And so, the short answer to your question is yes, environmental DNA is a really effective tool to just like presence absence. It's not you can definitely get false negatives. You can definitely take a sample and get no platypus data there.
They just did a big study on Loch Ness and weirdly didn't get any Loch Ness monster data. So
surprise.
Monster dog.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You've been listening to an interview with Gilad Bino discussing the platypus. This is part one of a two-part look at these creatures. Today, we discuss the challenges for biologists in studying a solitary nocturnal mammal that likes to burrow into riverbanks. Next time, we'll be discussing the many peculiar biological features that make the platypus and monotremes in general so peculiar. But we'll also find that they don't represent a weird biological offshoot as much as an extreme survival of an ancient line. Egg laying, venom, electrical detection. We'll learn all about that stuff in our next episode. Check out our Monster Talk merchandise at monstertalk.org/store, where you can find a variety of cool products to show that you're a next level monster enthusiast. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as Good Job Brain, I Know What Scares You, and I Know What Scares You. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. You could have done a lot of things with your time, but you chose to spend it with us, and for that, we thank you.
Been a Monster House presentation.